What else is there to know about what your work or the challenges of dealing with a gigabyte a second of data, like we were talking about before?
I should probably talk about some of my lunatic fringe views on things.
Oh, we love lunatic fringe views. there's people on Channel 9 who would love it.
I'm a big fan of building out of simple components and doing what's called scale out, where you make a unit that does something, and then you come up with an architecture where you can just take it and divide it in half, and take the task and divide it in half, and spread it out as wide as possible. That gives you a kind of fault tolerance. If one of the things fails, then you still have the processing power of everybody else, and if that thing fails, it doesn't wipe out everything else. But if you replicate your data inside of that cluster, you get two kinds of fault tolerance. Then you have if 1/100th of it fails, if one node of 100 fails, you've still got 99% of your processing power, and you have 99% of the information. And if each piece of information is stored in two places, then you've still got a copy of the information. So an interesting thing is that the way the Terra server works now is, and there's a paper on my website that describes the old architecture and the new architecture. The old Terra server architecture, which is the one done in 2000, was built with fairly high-end processors and a SAN. And the new architecture is 20 times cheaper, which is to say about $100,000 instead of $2 million, has way more storage, 3 times more storage, and has way more processing power. So how do you get more stuff for 20 times less? Well, you go off and buy commodity, everything. SATA disk drives, Opteron processor, you know, and so on. And you don't buy a SAN. Okay. SAN is not commodity. And this is the SAN architecture versus the brick architecture. And the SAN architecture, we used Microsoft Cluster Service, and we had failover, and we guarded that disk farm very carefully, because if the disks went south, we were screwed. Okay. I mean, if the SAN went south, we were screwed. And in this new architecture, every brick has a third of the database, or a quarter of the database. And every database is stored in two bricks. And we mirror within a brick, and then we mirror the bricks. And bricks cost $10,000, and they store about 3 terabytes. So about $3,000 a terabyte. And we have a spare brick just sitting there waiting for something bad to happen. And if, God forbid, one of the bricks were to fail, which has actually never happened, we would quickly copy the good guy to the spare guy. So this is what's called 2N plus 1 redundancy. Okay? And when you've got, 10 nodes, it's only 10% to have an extra spare. And if you have 20 nodes, which is, if you have 10 useful nodes, you're going to have 20 actual nodes. It's 5%, so it's like less than sales tax in California to have this extra redundancy. And it has a huge impact on your availability, because the availability is proportional to your mean time to failure, but also is proportional to your mean time to repair. And this gives you very short repair times. You don't have to fix the hardware, you just make a copy of it. So the Terra server has gone to this brick design, and the brick design has been more reliable than SAN was for us. So that has been the other surprise. And again, this paper on the website talks about the reliability of the bricks for the first year of operation. And it's now been 6 more months, and we still haven't had... In 6 more months, we'll write another paper saying, no trouble found, sort of, you know. But my premise is that we are heading towards a world in which things are built from bricks, and that we're really in a transitional state where we are still time-sharing processors among disks. So what I mean by that is that when you buy a computer, you buy a computer, and then you attach disks to it. And I think the day is coming where you'll just buy a storage brick, which will essentially be a disk, and the processing and memory will come along with it. If you look at where the cost goes in the computer systems, it's not the CPUs, it's not the RAM, it's the storage.
Mm-hmm.
A disk drive costs $200, and I mean for PCs, it's the screen is what's expensive part.
Yeah.
And for servers, it's the disks. Okay? And so my premise is that we will be building these storage-oriented architectures where you buy the storage and along comes the database system and the operating system and the web server and all that sort of stuff. And so I describe these as smart disks as being the, you know, future architecture. The other thing that is a war that we're going to see waged over the next few years is that in the 1980s, the database guys came out with this thing called client-server architecture, and where you could put stored procedures inside of your database, and you could have a client that would send messages to the server, and the thing that went back and forth was request-reply to a stored procedure. And the database guys at that time were not very good at scalability, and in particular, a connection to Oracle or a connection to DB2 or even a connection to SQL Server had a huge footprint, a megabyte or two per connection. And appreciate that in 1980 a megabyte was a lot, and in 1990 a megabyte was a lot.
Yeah.
1980 a megabyte was all the memory, and 1990 it was a large fraction. So this created a situation where you needed something called a transaction processing monitor. And so there were transaction processing monitors like Tuxedo and CICS and ACMS from DEC and Pathway and various TP monitors. And time passed, and along came the web. And what these TP monitors did is multiplexed many clients to this server and gave, and it had a few connections to the database, and it multiplexed all the requests in through these few connections. Along comes the web, and the TP monitors get replaced by the web server, Apache or IIS. And what Apache and IIS do is they open up a pool of connections, and all of these requests come in, and they multiplex these requests against the pool of connections. And so web servers are acting as TP monitors. With UConn, UConn listens to port 80. UConn publishes a SOAP interface. Any stored procedure you got, you push a button, it's on the internet. Okay? You don't need IIS or Apache anymore. Now, well, how is SQL going to do with all those connections? Well, first, a megabyte isn't a lot anymore. But the other thing is that SQL is free-threaded. SQL actually has worked hard to support lots and lots of connections, so they've tested with a few thousand connections. So we are going to see over the next few years this war fought again, where we go from three-tier to two-tier. Client-server is dead. Client-server is simpler because one of the things that's happening is you can now program in one language everywhere. You can program in C# in your stored procedures. You can program C# in your front end. You can put C# in your web pages. You know, so you don't find yourself with JavaScript here, C++ here, Perl here, Transact SQL here, and all the horrors of having to have all those languages in your head and all of the, you know, different data types and slightly different exception handling. You basically have this one programming environment, which is, say, C# or Java if you're in that camp. And so you got this one language, and you in fact have a client and a server and nothing in between, because every piece of moving part, every moving part is another thing that could break. So I think there will be a group of people who are considered retro we'll go back to this two-ball model of computing, and it's going to be interesting to watch. A serious problem is that we've learned about DMZs, and you don't really want to put your assets on the internet. You want to have a protection walls. And one of the things that the web server does is it gives you a demilitarized zone, something that sits in the middle, and somebody has to break into the web server, and then they have to break into the database. Mm-hmm. And Lord knows SQL has a great big attack surface.
Yeah.
So it may not be the best thing in the world to put SQL on the internet, okay, because it's got this great big attack surface. But you can use VMs, you can use, you know, virtual machines, or you could wrap SQL in a shell and seal off all the ports except port 80 and so on. So I think there's going to be a lot of innovation in this space, because the simplicity of client server and the ability to just program in one language and only, you know, a request comes in, it doesn't need to go through, you don't have to have virtual directories and all this kind of craziness that, I have one part of my head that keeps track of how do I deal with IIS, I have another part of my head that keeps track of how I deal with SQL, and a third part of my head deal with how I deal with the event loop and graphics and GDI on the client side. And if I could eliminate one of that, it would make my life a lot simpler. And probably I'd have fewer things that could go wrong. So I think this is another place where there's going to be, there'll be bloody wars. There'll be people lined up on both sides. There'll be people saying, you idiot, you know, we fought this battle when I was a kid, and we concluded that it was best to have the three-tier model. You know, you're going to repeat the sins of the past. And the other person will say, it's simpler. and both sides are right.
Sure.
So,
which one are you going to pick?
I'm always for simpler. Okay? And the reason for simpler is, you know, it's lower cost. I mean, the pivotal issue here is how expensive is it to program, how expensive is it to manage and maintain. Mm-hmm. So, it's the two-ball model is a non-starter if there's the security problem can't be fixed. But I'm betting on people fixing the security.
Now, the only question that comes immediately to mind, two-tier model, is where do web services fit in? So, for example,
SQL is a web service.
So, but I mean,
in the new world, the TDS, which is, you know, there's SQL Server has. I'm anticipating. Why not let you finish your question?
No. Yeah. Well, I meant like in today's model, from a programmer's point of view.
Yeah.
I basically go and consume an XML file, which mm-hmm. I then
yeah.
convert that into a class
right.
as a proxy,
mm-hmm.
and then I program against it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that with the two-tier model, SQL will also provide that sort of
right.
rich XML
right.
representation.
So, you know, I talked to Don Box a fair amount, and Don is trying really hard to convert me, but he hasn't succeeded yet. So I still think that web services and SOAP is about remote procedure call. And I don't want to have to parse the XML document on the way in. I would like somebody else to serialize it for me, please. And every single web service I've ever written is, I make a remote procedure call, I present an array, I present a class or a structure, it pops up on the other side as a class or a structure. And I never see any XML. Okay. Don says, oh, you stupid idiot. You're not supposed to do it synchronously. You're supposed to do it asynchronously. And you're not supposed to trust a serializer, because the Microsoft serializer and the IBM serializer and the Sun serializers are different, and they can't talk to each other. And I say, yes, they can. There's this access thing. They agree. There's an array. There's a list. You know, if you stay in the narrow sphere of what's agreed to, in fact, the serializers all do interoperate. Hmm. And so, in particular, we have Perl and Python and Java and so on talking to the Sky server, and we trust the serialization on both and so on. But, the simple story is that SQL is a web service. And you can write stored procedures in C# or in Transact SQL with parameters, integers and character strings and simple structures. And you can literally go to a wizard, and they will turn it into a web service. And it gets registered. It has a disco file. It has Swizzle. It has soap. It has, you know, and so on. And it's sitting there on port 80, and ostensibly, somebody out there is doing WS security for you. And you can do policy-oriented things about saying, only people in this security class, and all that WS security gunk is done for you, automatically. Okay? And so the DBA can control who can call which things, and do delegation, all that sort of wondrous stuff. I mean, it's a pretty nice story. Okay. So, I mean,
are we going to see you and Don debating at the PDC?
Oh, it'd be pretty funny. You know, Don's absolutely right. I'm retro. I mean, I have written a lot of concurrent code. If I can avoid writing concurrent code, I will do it. Okay? I mean, concurrency is not simple. I mean, you know, request reply, not simple. The way I do request reply is I say NQ. And my request, I know I haven't NQ'd it until I get a reply back saying, I NQ'd your request. And what I get back is a ticket. And then I poll on my ticket. Or, Lord knows, my request provided a callback. And he calls back to me. But I hate callbacks because that's interrupt programming. I'll probably give him a cue and ask him to post the answer back into this queue, and I will. So, but, you know, anybody who's written asynchronous code knows that, you know, the first question you ask yourself is, how could I avoid writing this code? Okay. Now, we live in a disconnected world. We live in an occasionally connected world. You have to have queued programming. You have to have asynchronous. But you can program asynchrony as though it's synchronous. And, in fact, that's what I try to do. One of the early things I did was to work on blocking and concurrency control, and, you know, develop the theory of serializability and so on. And I got a Turing Award for figuring that stuff out. And I mean, there are theorems there, and the theorems. If you challenge me right now, I could probably go off and state the theorem and probably prove it, but most people couldn't. And the whole thing about that theory is, if you do this, it's as though there's no concurrency. And almost everybody operates above that theorem and just counts on the SQL guys to make all the concurrency go away. You say begin transaction, you party on the data, you say commit, and you don't have to worry about somebody changing the data underneath you.
True.
Okay? And that's not concurrent. And the whole business about asynchronously, what makes it complicated is the following, and it's not obvious that this is what makes it complicated, but I think it's what makes it complicated. A sequential program, you think of a state machine, and you're in this state or this state or this state, and the number of states you can be in is n, and you can look you can think of it as circles and arrows. You can look at it, and it's the number of circles. That's the number of states. You now have two computers that are operating asynchronously. They each have n states. Okay, the problem is that the state space of the pair is n times m. It's not m plus n. If they're concurrent, this guy can be in any one of his m states. This guy, and so if this is 10 states and this is 10 states, it's 100 possible pairs. And synchronous programs would be 20 instead of 100. And the combinatorics of parallel programming is what drive you crazy. It makes testing really tough. It just makes conceptualization really hard. And, in fact, the way people deal with it is they make it sequential. They put in locks. They put, say, a protocol. They say, you do this, and then I'll do this. And then they can turn that, take that state space and cut it down to something they can get their head around. Because, you know, the psychologist will tell you, you know, we can handle seven, or actually five plus or minus two things, I think it's the thing. So, you know, between three and seven things is like the limit of a human intelligence. And parallelism gets you past seven real fast.
Yeah, that's a very interesting problem. We're going to be, I'm actually going to be talking with a group at Microsoft who are working on the concurrency problem, Herb Sutter, and some other architects, thinking about how to approach, like, what is the problem, how do we approach it, because
right.
with the advent of multi-core processors, et cetera, they're telling programmers now we got to really start thinking about writing concurrent code,
yeah.
And as you just said, it's very difficult to write concurrent code correctly and yeah. reliably,
yeah.
and so yeah. it's very timely that you brought that up, very interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like I say, I'm in favor of these brick designs. Now, when you got a million processors, you got to run in parallel. How do you do that? Well, you ask the programmer to write sequential programs, and then you run those programs in parallel, cloning them. So there's a this is really an area of active ferment of, you know, how do we get parallels? SQL gets parallelism automatically. You write in SQL, they take it and they break the thing up for you in parallel. They use multiple disks, they use multiple processors, great. That's probably the most successful parallel programming environment. The number of people who've written MPI programs, which is the next most popular parallel programming thing, is not large. It's a very, very small, and many people use the packages that other people have built with MPI. It's really much more the model of how things work. And as long as you have a fairly low level of abstraction of concurrency, there are going to be relatively few people who can deal with that. So there's a paper that I really like. It's people at Google Labs wrote it called MapReduce. And it is how the people at Google do their parallel programming. Highly recommended
okay.
paper. You know, they are operating on a scale of a few thousand nodes. I've been working with the astronomers to build 100-node clusters where we can run their analysis tasks highly parallel. And the challenge is, how can you do it automatically? How can you, build a system where the programmer thinks he's writing a sequential program, and the system actually runs in parallel? And again, I hate to keep coming back to SQL, but it's it's the best example I've got. If you can come up with a function that applies to each record in a database, SQL will go off and run that function as parallel as it can. So if as many processors as there are and as many nodes as there are, it will apply that function to the records using as much CPU as possible. So one strategy is to have this data flow programming which is driven off the database. And the thing, in fact, that I'm pursuing is to take the MapReduce concepts and the data flow concepts that have been floating around for many years and I've been thinking about for many years, and to reconceptualize them in the context of having a CLR and having SQL spread across an array of machines. And more on that later. I mean, it's an idea, not we don't have any clear results yet. Right now, it's more or less manual. We get very good speed ups when we do it by hand, but how could we do it automatically?
Fascinating. Mm-hmm.
It's been a fun hour.
Good.
Absolutely. Thank you
yep.
for your time.
Thank you.